headlines that I brought up on Reddit News. I know a lot of us get our news on the internet now, and I kind of like Reddit because it doesn't have all the glitz and glamour of the Kardashians or anything like that. It's generated by the readers, and it's prioritized by what readers think is important. And here's a few of five of the headlines recently. The U.S. and U.K. hacked into the Israeli drone and jet live feeds during intelligence operations. Cyber attacks caused disruption for online banking. Stolen Uber accounts worth more than credit cards. Don't let your baby monitors get hacked. And the last one, which is the most concerning to me, NSA collecting millions of faces from web images. Every company is in the business of getting your data, so why would we think it would be any different with the government? When the government begins collecting data and web images of faces, I think we need to be concerned. And why is this relevant to a church service? Well, because religious freedom is one of the first things to go in a totalitarian society. Is this the direction we're heading with the internet? Is this vehicle which gives us such freedom to research and stay in touch with friends thousands of miles away actually constraining our freedom and compromising our democratic principles, and one, of course, being the freedom to worship as we please? I was drawn to this subject while reading Jonathan Franzen's new book, Purity, which follows a man who grew up in East Germany under the communist rule and the ever-present surveillance of the Stasi, the East German secret police. As it described life there, one realizes that the eavesdropping the Stasi did was not necessarily that expensive. Files were kept, but daily spying on citizens took a lesser role because they created an environment where people implicitly knew that they needed to conform or they'd be spied upon. It took only a few scapegoats and the population conformed, which, argued Franzen, and I quote, produces a vast amount of shame by not being able to conform or by conforming. Either way, the shame tank appears to be full. People succumb, they lose their will to oppose. They, by doing nothing, become collaborators and they conform. In this novel, Andreas, the East German, eventually ends up in Bolivia setting up a WikiLeaks organization, employing many disenfranchised young people from throughout the world, in its today's world. One being a newly graduated student from California carrying $130,000 in student debt. She's disillusioned by the promise of a good job when she gets out of school, which she didn't get. This message was given to so many of our young people getting out of college with mountains of debt. They're disillusioned. So they become hackers and they don't see it as wrong to expose all the information gathered on the internet. This disillusionment plays a big part, Franzen makes us realize, in young hackers going into this line of work, just like Edward Snowden. Not that he had student debt, but he felt disillusioned and disenfranchised. We are compelled to see similarities between the eavesdropping that Andreas grew up with in East Germany and what he's extracting today from the internet about people. The covert, subtle relinquishing of freedom is apparent in both environments. But who are we to be shocked by this? Privacy becomes a non-issue once you engage in social media or research on the web. You're opening yourself up for surveillance, not just by hackers, but by the government, by religious groups, by terrorists even. Using a pre-internet character in this book, Purity, to bring his point of diminishing freedom and the clandestine stifling of the voice of democracy and liberalism, Franzen shows us how those in power can claim to liberate human potential when in fact they're constraining it. Even in politics today, there's a radical conformity due to the political polarization on both sides, especially with the way they use their internet. Today's candidates simplify their policies by tweeting snippets, totally conforming to Twitter culture and other social media. The soundbites and platitudes vocalized to garner votes do not reveal much about the candidates. or their policies, which but brings conformity in the viewer who really learns very little about them. Perhaps that's why Trump is so popular. And is this good for our democracy? One could argue that more people are being reached, yet it's always within the constraints of social media, which packages everything in such a limited way. We do not really learn very much. Very little dialogue emanates from this kind of communication. We conform to the parameters of social media, which can compromise creativity and make us lazy. We need to be careful with this, especially in journalism, because journalism is one of the real founding principles to keep or expose these kinds of things. In the book Purity, this book that I speak of, the role of the press was touched upon, and I'm going to quote what they said about it. "The irony of the internet is that it's made journalists' jobs so much easier. You can research in 5 minutes what it used to take 5 days to research. But the internet is also killing journalism. There's no substitute for the reporter who's worked the beat for 20 years, who has cultivated sources, who can see the difference between a story and a non-story. When I'm at the computer, I'm only half alive," this character says in the book. It's been said that the new journalism is trying to get the story out before it goes viral. This creates haste, which can compromise true quality journalism. Now that we've touched upon the political and journalistic side of conformity in the internet era, how can this play out in a pluralistic society from a religious standpoint? Let's take a Muslim immigrant arriving in this country today. With the perceived threats that we may or may not be facing in regards to terrorism, I guarantee that the immigrants are being monitored. Their every move on social media, which sites they visit, are all being looked at by the government. Not so with Christians, even though we have Christian domestic terrorists. I don't think it's happening. Once we start singling out a certain religious group, we're walking a very slippery slope. And when the government tells us that it's for the greater good, do we agree or do we become complicit? Getting back to East Germany, the same argument was made back then. The East German government needed to protect its people from Western imperialists. Slowly, the protection evolved into complicity and monitoring, then passivity, then collaboration, then conformity. Before long, neighbors were spying on neighbors for the good of the country. I will end with a quote from Julian Assange, WikiLeaks. I paraphrase. "The internet could be turned into a dangerous facilitator of totalitarianism. The totalitarian playbook works by using the argument that government does. We have to use these eavesdropping methods because we're protecting you from our enemies. And this eavesdropping method is the only defense against them. The internet and the technology which surrounds it is the genie out of the bottle. Assange says, we will self-censor and the government will achieve the results it wants without lifting a finger." I have to end this talk by asking you, is this really the direction we want to be headed? And I will throw in one last thing. I don't know if you saw it in the news the other day that the UN court ruled that Julian Assange was being arbitrarily detained, pretty much illegally. So you get two sides of the story there, too. Thank you.
Marsha, would you like to take responses and comments?
Okay.
I think it's on. Is it on?
Comments, questions, responses.
Well, I very good talk. I sat here and started thinking about things, ping-ponging around in my head, and one of the things that came to me was, well, you know, well before the internet came along, George Orwell said that the truth in his day was a very, very, it's always a very, very hard thing to come by, even when it's at your fingertips. In terms of the internet being a threat, I think the biggest problem is, in terms of information being censored, we already have that problem with the media itself. And I consider this the golden age of media. It used to be the golden age of television, the golden age of radio, the golden age of print. It took forever to get through that one. It's being dominated by six corporations, which I think is a much bigger threat to the truth than anything else. And in terms of the internet getting information, most of it's voluntarily given to Facebook. We give it away voluntarily. They don't necessarily have to eavesdrop. And that's the culture we live in. And I find it interesting that in some cases, like my daughter, who's 23 years old, loathes the idea of having anything close to a Facebook account. She has an email account. I think she's kind of an odd person out on this, but she has one email account and no other web presence. So maybe there'll be a backlash to the internet among future generations. I don't know.
I won't be surprised to see that happen, actually. When I was looking for quotes
to the to use, I can't tell you how many of them came out of 1984, a book by George Orwell. That was a very prophetic novel.
Also, you have to balance what we get so much from the internet that's positive. I mean, we do have access to information at our fingertips. But it does concern me that there are four or five media corporations that are running, most of what's out there.
99%.
That's pretty scary.
You brought up a lot of points that I've run past my own mind when I've been on the computer. One of the other things is that people will just visit the sites that support their own rigid ideology, and this becomes dangerous too, as we can see in the current Republican debate. Particularly, I think Trump's success is partly because he has a grasp of what the modern media does. And he takes full advantage of it. One other thing, obviously, I forget the specific episode, but a while ago, wasn't a student at Rutland High trashed on the internet? And fortunately, the students banded together to oppose this kind of thing. But it seems to me this leads to conformity too. If you're not like us, if we don't like you, we're going to have a whole gang that's going to be on your case. That whole gang could easily become a government if you write this in large letters. So I enjoyed the talk.
Yes, it's frightening that you can go from such liberty to such conformity at the drop of a hat. If what you're looking at might appeal to you, but if it doesn't appeal to someone else, you could become the victim.
So, one thing that has been sort of present of late due to the election cycle and has a huge impact, I think, on shaping public conformity is an obsession with polls.
Yeah.
And the idea that we put polls out as if they're some sort of news when it's just other people's opinions. And in fact, a very small group of people's opinions. We start to see people who have less and less time to invest into searching for answers, less and less time to invest into research, putting stock in them as if they are some sort of news, and just an observation, I guess.
I think actually in the political system today, they do put their money where the polls go. And that's very concerning because it is just a few people's opinions. I'm glad Bernie didn't fall into that. Right from the beginning, he said, I don't care about the polls. And he just moved on, and it's worked for him, which is great.
There's a really great book that touches a lot on this subject called So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is at Rutland Library and at Phoenix Books. it's a fantastic book that tells a lot of stories about people communicating in their normal way that they normally would online, telling you, you know, if you would tell a joke to your friend, why not share it on Facebook? And then all of a sudden they're getting death threats from millions of people. Anyway, fascinating book, and it touches on the self-censorship that kind of public and permanent thing that the internet is.
One thing I just wanted to add is I believe, and this is a gross generalization, but when my kids first started going out on the internet, they didn't seem to have a filter. Everything went out there, like some of the personal stuff. And when I remember when my husband broke one of his bones, you know, my son was out there ready to put it out on Facebook. And my husband said, I don't want you putting it out on Facebook. I don't need those well wishes. You know, there's some personal stuff that, but the line is becoming more difficult to draw. And I think because the kids are growing up in this era, they don't, I don't know, they, because we didn't have it in the beginning. We have more of a filter where we'll stop at a certain point. But I think a lot of young people just put everything out there.
Oh, my comment is that, well, I'm going to echo a little bit what Bruce said, and I won't pile on about the bankruptcy of establishment journalism in the U.S. But one thing about the internet that is so cruel is that we're not restricted to establishment journalism within the United States. We can see establishment journalism in other countries too. There's the Asia Times online, which is really, really good. And interestingly enough, a lot of American journalists have gone over to Russia Today, which is the Russian English language news service. And Larry King's on there, Tom Hartman, there's a couple, Max Kaiser. There's some, you know, some big name journalists who are over there because they can talk about things that are in a non-NATO, intelligence establishment orbit here. But an interesting thing also is that we may be familiar with Seymour Hersh. He's, you know, like the Dean of American Investigative Journalists. And he normally publishes articles in the New Yorker, he has for years. But apparently, the articles he's published of late have been too hot for the New Yorker to handle somehow, yes, because they contradict the official narrative of what's going on in Syria in a big way. And so, you know, the idea, I guess, is that Seymour Hersh just, you know, went crazy and lost his marbles. So he's, you know, but he did it, of course. But you can read his articles in the London Review of Books, which who the heck knows how to get that, but you can get it online. So you can actually... Seymour Hersh has been effectively taken off of the New Yorker, but he hasn't been censored because you can go online and read his articles.
That's a good point. And even like up at the lake in the summertime, we watch a lot of Canadian television, and RT TV is up there, CCTV, which is the Chinese version. And it is great to watch them because you do get a totally different perspective. But you know, you have to make the effort to look for it. It's not going to come in this, you know, genre of television that we have in the networks.
That's exactly the point I was going to make, that the whole search engines are set up that when you put in keywords, what shows up is the most popular uses of those words. So to get to the minority opinions on anything, you have to dig and dig and dig. So you have to know where you're looking, and you have to spend the time. But most people don't, so it just sort of, the tyranny of the majority is perpetuated.
One thing that happened to me when I took my daughter out to Salt Lake City to go to college, I don't know how they managed this, but on the TV, in the hotel, if I turned the TV off and I had it on CNN, when I turned it back on, it was automatically on Fox. And it was like a default. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. I don't know how they managed it, actually. I said to my daughter, I can't believe this. I never watch Fox. Every time I turn the TV on, it's on Fox.
I have a Google feed that provides numerous articles, and I can't figure out how they determine what I should be looking at. And one of the things that's there commonly is news from a network that I would not normally look at, and I have been reluctant to click on those articles because I don't want to be barraged with more from that source, although looking at another source for news and opinion is something that is happening less and less with individuals, and people are reinforcing their own opinions by following the same journalists or publications, and we're really kind of getting farther apart because of the way we choose to get our news.
I will admit sometimes I do watch Fox just to hear what's going on in your mind. I think that's important.
So first, technical aside, as a somewhat frequent traveler, I can tell you that I actually don't turn them on a whole lot, that hotel room TVs, wherever they buy them from, are set up so that they can be set to a default TV station. Typically, it's the Weather Channel, so it is interesting that you went to the hotel room and decided to make a default Fox News rather than something generic. But also, I was sort of pondering and curious what you might have to say. I don't know quite think of myself, but when you refer to people being disenfranchised and disillusioned, and yet I think, you know, when you talk about hackers, we're mostly talking about comparatively privileged white people. You know, there's certainly some real problems there, like student debt, but on the other hand, you're talking in that case about someone who got an American college degree that a lot of the world would kill to have, and apparently has the means to go to some other country and do what it is they choose to do. And so, you know, to what extent is there a element of a first world or not even maybe even white privileged people's problems in this?
That's true, but in their mind, they don't see it that way, I think. But I certainly perceive it that way. They did get an education, but I don't know, I still feel as though with the interest rates as low as they are, I don't know why we're charging these students at least 7 to 8% interest on their loans. I think that should have been taken care of a long time ago. But that's a whole other issue.
One last comment. Oh, I just saw Herb's hand go up next to the last comment. So, TVs in doctor's offices, airports, all of this hotels is for sale. It's advertising. It's it's considered real estate that is bought, and whether it's on an airplane or in a hotel room. And it's been around a long time. It's just that because of the type of media, you know, and in some places you can't even turn it off, but people buy, like, say Subaru or where there's service area, where they have a TV going constantly. All of this stuff is for sale. While I'm going up to get Herb's comment, I have to say one of the most delightful experiences I ever had was checking into a Finnish hotel and having the television say, "Welcome, Kathy Harm."
I'm wondering, when I go on Facebook and rummage around some, I'll find a fair amount of political comment, maybe some comment about sports, and maybe it's just the people that I have access to on Facebook. I hardly ever find anything about religion. So I'm wondering, does anybody have any experience with Facebook circles where the person who does the posting is, let's say, a very conservative Christian, and do they wind up with just a lot of comments supporting them, or is there actual discussion, I wonder?
That's a good question. I don't have a lot of that either, because I think most people that I associate with are of my religious mindset, perhaps, so they're not my friends on Facebook, or if they are, they just don't post. So I don't have an answer for that one.
The last comment.
So I do have a few folks that are on my, connected to the Facebook who are very, very conservative religious fundamentalists. And but usually they're posting personal things, but with political tints, and sometimes it is political or religious. And they do generally only get positive responses. And frankly, I refrain from responding, because I don't want to get into, some sort of back and forth on Facebook.
And I'm not even looking, so that was the last comment. Thank you, Marcia. I have to say, usually we have to pick the font for our sermon. It's handwritten.
I did it at work.
Please rise in body and spirit in singing our closing hymn, which is number 108. Thank you.
a service.
I'm just going to do my closing words. It again pertains to religion in this country. It's from a press release from Religious Freedom Poll that finds disparity. Americans place a higher priority on preserving the religious freedom of Christians than from any other faith group, ranking Muslims the least deserving of the protections from electronic surveillance. Charles Haynes, director of Religious Freedom Center at the Newseum Institute, said the findings reflect deep divisions among Americans about the very definition of religious liberty, which has taken on a newly politicized meaning in a time of debate. Religious freedom is now in the eye of the beholder. People in different traditions with different ideological commitments will define religious freedom differently.
Kept recording.